You're listening to the Ideas Network of Wisconsin Public Radio. I'm Joy Cardine. It's 10 minutes past 8 o'clock on this Thursday morning, May the 22nd. It was just about 30 years ago when the first test tube baby was born, conceived in a petri dish, the first baby born through in vitro fertilization, a form of assisted reproduction. And we have come a long way since then. With technology and surrogates and other methods allowing single men and women and gay men and women to become parents through assisted reproduction. Our guest says that this is changing the world. She is the author of the book Everything Conceivable, How Assisted Reproduction is Changing Men, Women, and the World, and we welcome your thoughts and questions for her at 1-800-642-1234, in Madison 263-1890, 263-1890. Perhaps you yourself have gone through assisted reproduction or know someone who has. We welcome your story, your experience. We will also talk about why the need to be a parent and a biological parent in many cases is so overwhelming that people will put themselves through the high cost and the medical and psychological and legal consequences of assisted reproduction. We'll wonder if the industry is regulated enough, and we'll wonder if society is better off with this technology, or whether you are concerned about the various ethical issues that arise from it, like half-siblings living in the same community, perhaps, not knowing that they're half-siblings. 1-800-642-1234 in Madison, 263-1890. Let me welcome our guests. Lisa Monday is a feature writer for the Washington Post magazine. And she is the author of Everything Conceivable, How Assisted Reproduction is Changing Men, Women, and the World. Good morning.
Good morning. If I could just say it's Liza Monday.
I'm very sorry, Liza.
It happens all the time.
So why did you want to write a book about assisted reproductive technologies?
Well, I've always been interested in family issues, and I've always been interested in reproductive politics. I'm a writer for the Washington Post, and I've, on and off over the years, have written about abortion and contraception issues and cultural politics surrounding that. And several years ago, an editor assigned me to write an article about infertility as experienced by the poor, people who often can't afford the high-tech procedures or often adoption as well. And that was a real eye-opening story for me. I learned that infertility is actually more common the lower your tax bracket. And the old cliche, the rich get richer and the poor have children, is often not true. Much infertility is caused by relatively simple infections that, if they're left untreated, can have major consequences. And simply because of lack of access to good health care, the less money you have, the less likely you are to have gotten this health care. At the same time that I was reporting that story, I was learning how common the experience of infertility is among my own colleagues and friends. And after the story ran, it was very controversial. There were some people who wrote in and said that they thought that if someone couldn't afford fertility treatment, they couldn't afford a family. And why did everybody think they just had a right to have children? But some people were very sympathetic, and I was having lunch with a woman who had sent some money to one of the couples named in my piece, and she herself was pregnant with IVF twins, so she was about to have the experience of delivering and raising twins, which is increasingly common thanks to reproductive technology. And she also talked about the fact that she and her husband had access frozen embryos from this procedure and had really no idea what would be the right thing to do with them. They had thought starting out that they would donate any excess embryos to another couple experiencing infertility. But now that she was pregnant and contemplating the idea of her own children's full siblings being raised in another household, she found that she really couldn't go through with that and didn't know what the right thing was to do. And she and I had both come of age in the 1980s when the concept of choice, the word choice really meant one thing. If you were pro-choice, it meant that you supported a woman's right to decide the fate of her own pregnancy. But it just became clear to me that the menu of choices, thanks to these new technologies, had expanded so much, and that everyone going through this procedure was facing really unprecedented choices, for which I think we're all unprepared.
Yeah, and give us some idea of that menu of choices. There's more than just in vitro fertilization between a married man and woman.
Right. Mm-hmm. Well, absolutely. And even in what they now call old-fashioned IVF, which shows, you know, how quickly this has changed, there's the choice of how many embryos to transfer, and the decision about whether you feel like you could raise twins or triplets if you transfer more than one embryo, and then, of course, what to do with excess embryos at the end. And that's just in straightforward IVF. But if, say, you're a woman around the age of 40 and IVF is not working with your own eggs, doctors will increasingly say now, well, how about moving on to donor egg? How about just using another woman's eggs to conceive your child? It'll be no big deal. It's just another step in the medical process. And an increasing number of women are availing themselves of this option. But then they have to ask themselves, you know, will it matter to my child that I am not his or her genetic mother? Should I tell my child? If I tell my child, what and when should I tell my child? For my book, I interviewed a woman who had egg donor twins, and they were sitting on the kitchen counter. She was baking cookies, and she was looking at them saying, you know, what am I going to say to them, and when am I going to say it? I also lead my book with the anecdote of an Episcopal priest who received an email from a parishioner whose triplet she was getting ready to baptize, and the triplet and the mother wanted her to incorporate the egg donor into the baptismal ceremony. So this priest, had to sit there and think, what is an egg donor? What is a genetic mother? What is her role in the human family? And how should she be honored or thanked in this, you know, ancient baptismal ceremony? For the first time in human history, a woman can now give birth to a child who is genetically unrelated to her. Mm-hmm. And that's never been possible before. And it's I think, you know, challenging our definition of what makes for a parent, and what is the importance of genetic connection to your child.
Yeah, I was reading, you mentioned that a child could be born today that has, I thought you mentioned five parents.
Well, that's true. Mm-hmm. And I did interview people. If you use an egg donor, a sperm donor, and a surrogate to gestate the child, then there would be five people involved. It's not happening every day, but it does happen.
Yeah. And didn't you also have the story of two gay men who employed the services of a surrogate, and they both had genetically their own children in the two children that the surrogate bore?
That's right. There's a chapter in my book, and it's been a fairly controversial chapter, on the increasing use of surrogacy by gay men who want to be parents. Surrogacy has always been controversial, but it is permitted in a number of states, and traditionally has been a situation where a woman helps another woman. Often the intended mother is a woman whose uterus maybe is malformed from DES exposure or maybe perhaps uterine cancer. But increasingly, surrogacy is something that gay men are availing themselves of, and surrogates in general like to work for gay men because they tend to be quite quite grateful and easy to get along with, and there's no competition or jealousy between an infertile woman and a fertile woman. So, yes, I profiled two men who living in San Francisco who first selected an egg donor and put quite a lot of thought into that process, looking at things like SAT scores and extracurricular activities and physical characteristics. And then they contracted with a surrogate to gestate these embryos, and they did something that's not uncommon in gay parenting, which is they did what's called a mixed batch transfer, which means they procured eggs from the egg donor, they split the batch in half, and each man inseminated half of her eggs, and two from each man were transferred into the surrogate, which four embryos total, which is a bit of a risk. The possibility of quadruplets certainly existed. In this case, two of the embryos took, and the men ended up with twin daughters who are, in fact, genetic half-siblings because each daughter is the genetic child of a different man.
Yeah, it's really, everything is conceivable, isn't it?
Yeah.
The multiple births, that alarms you, doesn't it?
was really the some people are shocked by these new family formations, and like the story of the gay men. I was more shocked, really, by the impact of multiple births, which is something that I was not fully aware of when I started reporting. The number of twins born in our country has doubled in the past 20 years. It's about 130,000 per year, and the number of triplets has risen. At one point, it had risen by about 900%. It's down a little bit, but it's still risen by about 700%. And these, you know, these pregnancies can work out fine, but often they don't, and we often don't read about the tragic stories and the very, very difficult pregnancies. The human uterus is ideally a single occupancy dwelling. Women are really designed to carry one baby. And as a result of these technologies, often women are trying their hardest to carry two or three or sometimes four or more. And I just heard really tragic story after tragic story, I must say, in talking to parents.
Yeah. And while I know you're essentially a reporter of this information, the thought of perhaps regulating this industry so a clinic isn't putting in four or more embryos into a woman might be something worth considering.
I do. Mm-hmm. And the so-called industry, you know, has made an attempt in the past 5 years to bring down the number of embryos transferred, but there's no enforcement of it. It's a purely voluntary effort. A clinic doesn't get kicked out of the association if it violates these guidelines. And so some clinics have done a good job, and some clinics don't really seem to be trying that hard, because the more embryos you transfer, the more likely you are to have a pregnancy. And all clinics are very aware of success rates, and they want to keep their pregnancy success rates high. And transferring a number of embryos is one way to do that.
We're talking with Liza Mundy. She is the author of Everything Conceivable, How Assisted Reproduction is Changing Men, Women, and the World. Has it changed you or anyone you know? 1-800-642-1234. In Madison, 263-1890. I'm Joy Cardine. This is the Ideas Network. You're listening to the Ideas Network. I'm Joy Cardine. Good to have you along. Hope you stay tuned. Ben Marins is with you this afternoon between 4 and 6. After 5, Ben's guest historian compares the Bush and Nixon administrations in the wake of President Carter's controversial weekend comments about the worst administration ever. We're talking about assisted reproduction and how it has grown, how it has changed since the first test tube baby was born some 30 years ago. Now, our guest says, and her book says, everything conceivable. Everything is conceivable. 1-800-642-1234 in Madison, 263-1890. Wondering if you have any concerns about assisted reproduction, whether you think that this industry is regulated enough. Any concerns about the ethical issues that arise from assisted reproduction? We welcome your questions and comments for our guest, Liza Mundy, who is the author of Everything Conceivable, How Assisted Reproduction is Changing Men, Women, and the World. And let's go to the phones. Carolyn in Madison is with us first. Hi, Carolyn. You're on the air.
Hi. How are you today?
Good.
I just wanted to comment. I did in vitro fertilization 2 years ago, and actually my twins are just turning two today.
Happy birthday.
Oh, thanks. But the comment I wanted to make was our decision to do in vitro fertilization versus adoption actually just stemmed from the fact that in vitro seemed easier for us. The adoption process just seemed daunting and very long. And I was just wondering, you know, regarding her comments regarding that.
Yeah. I'd be glad to comment about that, because I think infertility patients do have to listen a lot to comments from people saying, well, why don't you just adopt, as though just adopting is a really easy process. And it's not these days. The number of infants available for domestic adoption has fallen, has plummeted since the 1960s, as more women are keeping their children and as abortion has become safe and legal. And so it's not necessarily an easy road. It's not necessarily any cheaper than IVF. IVF can be cheaper. It's obviously a wonderful option, but there are many reasons why people choose IVF treatment, and the, what the caller says is exactly one of them. And I've run into this a lot on radio shows. People will call in and say, well, there's so many needy children out in the world. Why don't these people just adopt them? And I think it's really not fair to burden the infertile with the responsibility for all the needy children in the world. I mean, if adoption is, and of course it's a wonderful thing, but then we all should be out adopting as well. So I agree with your caller.
Yeah, Carolyn, are you still there? Oh, too bad. But there are parents, though, or men and women who do want a biological child. And if there is an infertility issue, a blocked fallopian tube, a low sperm count, or whatever of the husband, that they're still they'll go through this assisted reproduction to have their own genetically related child.
Yes, I do sometimes think that the urge for a biological child is part of what's driving it. As I said, I lead my book with a woman who became pregnant with an egg donor. So obviously, a lot of times what people end up doing is a procedure that involves a child that's not genetically their own child. But certainly, I have a whole chapter on male infertility, and you know, which is as common as female infertility. And in the 1990s, a procedure was invented called ICSI, which involves the direct injection of a sperm into an egg, which really revolutionized fertility treatment for men, and all but cured male infertility. But this procedure, if a man has a very low sperm count, you know, doctors can now go in and retrieve the sperm, and then the embryologist in the lab can inject it into the egg. But this does mean that if a son is born, he likely will have the same low sperm count if it's due to a glitch in the Y chromosome. And, you know, and doctors kind of laugh about this. We're creating our next generation of infertility patients. And whenever you ask them about informed consent, you know, are you advising these patients, you know, about the consequences of perpetuating this male infertility and possibly other genetic issues, they sort of laugh and say, yeah, we do, but nobody ever, you know, really worries about it. And I do think that there is sometimes a drive to have a biological child, even if that child is going to inherit some defects, you know, some flaws. But I think also often when people go through these procedures, you know, women want to experience pregnancy often. And I think when women avail themselves of egg donors, part of the motivation is experiencing pregnancy, which just goes to show how far we've come. You know, pregnancy used to be such a dangerous, life-threatening situation, and it's now viewed, I think, by many women as an experience they'd like to have.
But I'm thinking, the last I looked into it, and I did look into this, in vitro fertilization was about $10,000 or more for each attempt. You had, the woman had to go through some questionably safe hormone injections to stimulate ovulation and multiple eggs. And it really was still an emotional roller coaster because the success rates weren't that great in terms of whether this would you would conceive or not. So it is quite a lot of barriers to get over to conceive this way.
That's true, and I wouldn't disagree with any of that. And I would also say that in these cases of male infertility, you know, it is the woman who's taking those hormones, and in some cases gestating a multiple pregnancy. So all that you say is true. I think that the experience can be, for some couples, relatively easy. I have a neighbor who has three children as a result of IVF. She had a relatively minor you know, cause of her infertility that was fairly easily resolved by IVF. So in their case, it wasn't an agonizing process. And, you know, my son goes to school with their children, and they're wonderful. But absolutely, for some couples, it's just an absolutely harrowing process. It can get very expensive. And, of course, failure is more common than success.
Yeah, isn't it about is it still like a 20% success rate?
About one-third of IVF mm-hmm. cycles succeed, and about two-thirds don't. And so, of course, it can work on the second try, or it can work mm-hmm. on the third try. So ultimately, I think for couples going through it, if they stick with it for two or three, then the odds may go up. But yeah. But it's not easy, for sure.
And let's go to someone who's gone through this, Dawn in Madison. Hi, Dawn.
Hi there.
Hi.
Yes, I mean, I totally agree. I've had three in vitros in the early 1990s. The first one, they took 9 eggs out. They implanted 5. Wow. None of them took. The next time I went to and had another series done, they implanted 4, took out 4. 4 implanted those they didn't take. I had 4 frozen. And through the thawing process, only one survived, and that one was implanted, and I have a 10-year-old daughter.
Wow.
And I do truly agree that, you know, the body gets 5 eggs, and I'm wondering if it knows what to do with those 5 eggs. You know, one makes a lot more sense, or two, because our bodies can handle that better. But I do want to say I had this done in Madison, and a lot of it, too, is how you think about it. When I went in the last time, the third time, I brought everything that was really uplifting, positive. The nurse, when I was going through this, she bent down, she whispered in my ear, "I've never gone through one of these that didn't take." I mean, how positive is that? It was just really incredible.
Well, I'm glad that the very last egg that you had it worked, huh?
Yes.
Yeah. Liza Mundy?
Yeah, that's an incredible story, and it just goes to show how what a gamble it is with each embryo transfer. And I do tend to think that it would be good to minimize the number of embryos transferred. But it just goes to show that doctors, when they transfer, they have no idea really, and no way to diagnose whether all of them are going to take, or a few of them are going to take, or one of them is going to take. But I salute this patient's tenacity in sticking with it, because I'm sure it wasn't easy. And again, I think infertility patients sometimes get pegged as being desperate for this procedure to succeed, and that may be true in some cases, but I also think there's a lot of tenacity and resolve involved, and that's great that it turned out so well.
Yeah, some of the ethical issues that do arise then is if, say, Dawn's 4 or 5 embryos did all take, whether it would be healthy for her to carry all 4 or 5 babies, and whether there would be some sort of what do you call it, selective abortion?
Yeah, I have a chapter on this in my book as well, and I call it deleting fetuses. There's a procedure called selective reduction. This is a very inexact science, and it's absolutely true that if a woman conceives quadruplets or even triplets, you know, her risk of miscarriage is pretty high, and even if all babies, you know, are born, they're likely to be born premature, and the consequences of that can be really significant. And this is one of the most agonizing choices patients have to make when they are pregnant with multiples, is whether to carry the pregnancy or whether to, quote-unquote, reduce it. And I spent 2 days with a doctor in New York who does reductions, and it's really an agonizing thing to watch, I must say, because, you know, the decision has to be made once a person decides to reduce of which one is going to go. And they do genetic testing and they look at position. But then ultimately, it really feels like a Sophie's choice. And it was a hard thing to watch. And, you know, again, if there's any way to reduce the number of embryos and reduce the likelihood that somebody's going to have to make this choice, it would be a great thing.
Yeah, why is it that the industry, the assisted reproductive industry, is largely unregulated in the United States?
Well, you know, our medical system is so different from that of socialized countries. You know, we're not as regulated as doctors in, say, Canada or the UK anyway. But in the UK, where IVF first succeeded, and where there's a lot of public debate and public awareness about this, there is an agency that exists. All clinics must be licensed. And all procedures must be okayed by this central authority. In our country, we just don't have anything like that. And I think there's a perfect storm. IVF succeeded in this country under the Reagan administration. There was little or no funding for any research in the area. And funding research is one way that we regulate science and medicine, by funding the clinical trials and directing the research. And that just didn't go on. So we weren't actively funding research into this area, which is one of the reasons why different clinics have just wildly different protocols, because there's been no government-sponsored effort to come up with a standard protocol. But also, doctors don't particularly want to be regulated in this domain, and the patients often, I found, all aren't that interested in regulation, because they're afraid that if the government gets involved in the reproductive arena, that it'll be politicized. And I don't think they're necessarily wrong about that. So there's really sort of a perfect storm of reasons in this country why there's no group really lobbying for more regulation.
Yeah. Let's go to Janice in La Crosse next. Hi, Janice.
Hi, good morning. This is really, for me, this is like really scary conversation. And, I just really feel like we need to really think about what we're doing. Just because we can do it doesn't mean that we should do it. And I just feel like if we keep going on with this, multiple births and tampering with the sanctity of life, I mean, we're going to open up a real Pandora's box. And we already have in many ways. But, I mean, this is the scary thing of life. I mean, we need to be respectful of life, and God gave us life, and now man's deciding to do cloning or whatever he wants to do, multiple births, and to me, we cannot just step in and do these things. Even though we scientifically can do that, doesn't mean it's right to do them. And then what's the next generation? I love it, because we only talk about what people want to do. But what about the next generation of the children? Nobody, we don't know the repercussions of what's going to be going on here. Now, I would love to see Roe v. Wade, overturned, but we need to just get back to respecting life. Thank you.
Liza Mundy?
Well, I think, some people reacting to my book have found it to be scary. I would say, in terms of the reaction of the children, I was present at an event where two boys were there who were both, they were among the first generation of IVF patients, of IVF children, and one of them, I think, was 16 and one of them was 12, and they were asked to say a few words. And, like any other abashed teenager, one of them stepped forward. He said, it's kind of surreal to be, like, talking about how it's conceived and everything, but I'm basically just, really glad to have the technology that I can be here. And then his little brother, who had been frozen as an embryo, stepped up and he said, I'm just really grateful that I can be here and all the effort put into, me. And they were very charming and glad to be here. And 3 million children have been born as a result of IVF and at this point around the world. And I agree that we need to think hard about some of the procedures that are possible now. But I certainly don't agree that it's all bad.
Yeah. What are the procedures that you think we ought to think twice about besides the number of embryos that are implanted?
Yeah, well, that certainly, I mean, if it ever got around to reproductive cloning, I would be very comfortable with a ban on reproductive cloning. I think we need to think about the way that the sperm and egg donation industry, and it is very much a commercial industry in this country, we do need to think about the way that is conducted and organized. Right now, as you pointed out in your introduction, there's no effort made to track the number of egg or sperm donations that one donor contributes. There's no effort to track the children born, and I did interview a woman who was a single mother of twins using donated sperm, and she met a woman across the street from her, another single woman mother of twins, and it turned out that they had used the same sperm donor and that their children were half-siblings, and they never would have known that if they hadn't have happened to meet each other, and their kids would have gone to the same school. There's a very active conversation right now about, children now have come to of age who are adult donor offspring. These are children who were conceived when sperm donation was really the only treatment for male infertility, and it was done very secretively, and parents were told never to tell their children the truth. And there's a generation of adults now who found out late in life that they were the product of donor sperm, and they believe that, like adopted children, they have an absolute right to know that they are the product of donated gametes and to know the identity of the donor. And I think they have a pretty strong moral argument, actually. So I think the whole industry of commercialized egg and sperm donation should be looked at much more closely than it is in terms of tracking donations, and also maybe asking whether these donors should be known to the children. Whether or not that's going to happen, I'm not convinced.
Yeah. Didn't you say that in your book that in Great Britain that is the law, that by 18, somebody who donates sperm has to agree to have the child track them down?
That's right. And there's a centralized registry kept. What often happens in this country and others is that parents, if they conceive using donor sperm or donor egg, don't even necessarily tell the child that they're the product of a donor. And in England, anybody who gets to the age of 18 can go and find out whether or not donor conception was used, and they can also now find out the identity of the donor. Now, this has led, this is controversial, but it seems to have led to a decline in the number of people willing to donate.
Because they want to be anonymous.
Yeah. But in weighing the rights of the parents versus the rights of the child, in the UK, they've come down on the rights of the child.
We have Renee in Lake Geneva with us. Hi, you're on the air.
Hi. The reason I'm calling is I had a son through artificial insemination. It was the best choice for my husband and I, and God bless him, he's a beautiful little boy. But you've been mentioning how the industry is not regulated and stuff like that. I went through a cryobank in California, very regulated, very detailed. We got family history of the donor that we chose, and, you know, some problems arose, and they've been very, very helpful with dealing with that. And as far as ethical issues go, I can agree that there are some. I know that I'm a Catholic, and I went through a lot of debate before I decided to have my son. But with the, you know, there's no possibility that there's a very slim possibility that my son is going to find a biological sibling. And it is much more regulated than, you know, it used to be. But, and as far as the fact...
And I'm sorry, you think, Renee, that the chances are very low that your son would ever run into a half-sibling somewhere?
Well, yeah. I do. I know because of the fact that this is so spread out, and I do know that they told me that they can only have a certain number of mothers use the donor.
Yeah, isn't there some sort of restriction on that, Liza Monday?
Well, I should say that in terms of regulation, cryobanks are regulated in terms of doing disease testing on donors and providing a family medical history. And so, yes, that has all increased. It improved enormously, but in terms of capping the number of times a donor can donate, it's my understanding that if a sperm bank does cap the number of times, this is a voluntary thing. It's not anything that's enforced by the government or by a regulatory agency, and the same donor could conceivably, if he wanted to, go to another bank somewhere and contribute there as well. And what I mean by lack of regulation would be that there's nobody really keeping track of the number of times that a donor donates. I've certainly interviewed women in the Washington area who've donated eggs at three or four different clinics and been struck by the fact that there's nobody really keeping track of the number of times they've donated. And so I guess there are different forms of regulation. And I do think that these cryobanks now are particularly if they participate in the American Association of Tissue Banks, they are well regulated in terms of lab procedures and disease testing. But we don't have anything like England where people are actually actively keeping track of the number of times a donor donates.
We're way past break time. We're talking with Liza Monday. She is writer at the Washington Post magazine, the author of Everything Conceivable, How Assisted Reproduction is Changing Men, Women, and the World. And we welcome your thoughts and questions for her, maybe even your own experiences with assisted reproduction. 1-800-642-1234. 1-800-642-1234. In Madison, 263-1890. I'm Joy Cardine. This is the Ideas Network. This is the Ideas Network of Wisconsin Public Radio. I'm Joy Cardine, hoping you'll stay tuned. Kathleen Dunn is with you after 9 o'clock, and Kathleen will talk with the former director of the Milwaukee Violence Prevention Program and two of the peace facilitators from the Peace Learning Center in Milwaukee, coming up after 9 o'clock. We're talking about how assisted reproduction is changing men, women, and the world. Liza Monday is the author of Everything Conceivable. And are we changing the world for better or worse, Liza Monday?
Well, I would say I think that we're largely changing the world for the better. I am one who believes that typically it's better to be born than not to be born, and to have millions of children conceived through assisted reproduction, and millions of happy families, and parents who very much want children and are very motivated to have children. I think that's a great thing.
Anna in Oshkosh is with us. Hi, Anna.
Hi. I'm just curious about egg donation. I went to an Ivy League school, and there were always ads in the school paper trying to get young women to donate their eggs. And I knew a couple of women who went through this procedure, which seemed very invasive and dangerous. But it paid well. Did your book cover that issue at all?
Yeah, I do write about that. And you know, having just said this is all a great thing, I do share your reservations about the commercialization of egg donation. There are some large sums offered to women at Ivy League schools, you know, and it's funny, I'm a parent and my daughter's 11, and if she were in college, I wouldn't want her to donate eggs, I must say. And I have interviewed egg donors for whom it's really not a big deal, and I'm not really talking about college women. Egg donors in their, say, mid to late 20s, who often themselves do not want to have families and don't think that the medical procedure is a big deal and don't have a strong, you know, physical reaction to it, and are glad to do it. And I don't have a problem with that, but I do have qualms about offering $20,000 or $30,000 to 19-year-old women, mm-hmm. To offset their tuition by donating eggs. I do.
Yeah, thank you, Anna, for the call. Patty in South Range is next. Hi, you're on the air.
Hi. My husband and I went through intrauterine inseminations, you know, 12 years ago, before insurance covered a lot of this. And the cost was tremendous at that time. You'd have to take a break to get more money. And then we went to donor, and I understand totally what you're talking about as far as when do we say, what do we say, whose eyes color is going to be here. Mm-hmm. When we decided to adopt, that was a tremendous relief for us. We were just ready for that. It didn't matter to us whether this child was biologically ours or not. But does your book address how stressful all of this is on the marriage? Many marriages don't survive to the point of having the child born or the adoption. And if there's a multiple birth, there's a tremendously high divorce rate.
Yes, I think the you know, the stress of infertility and the stress of treatment on the marriage is not something I dwell on at length, because I felt as though that topic had been pretty well covered in books on infertility treatment. I do talk about the stress of multiples on parents and on marriages. One mother of triplets I interviewed, she and her husband had an adopted daughter who was 2, and then they went through IVF and they ended up with triplets, all of whom were born developmentally challenged and continued to have issues that unfolded. And for them, the sheer, you know, the any parent can sympathize with. I mean, just the exhaustion of the labor associated with four little children constantly having to do laundry, both spouses needing to work simply to be able to afford to pay for really little children and their needs, not being able to get one babysitter, always having to hire two babysitters, that stress was so intense on their marriage that they did end up getting divorced. They were just unable, really, I think, to find time for each other. It was very difficult. And I think that is true, certainly true of multiple births. So I do talk about the stress on marriages of different aspects of this treatment, yeah.
And Patty, you said before insurance covered this. I don't think insurance covers most of this, does it, Liza Mundy?
You know, I think a lot of policies do now.
Yeah.
Well, she was talking about IUI, intrauterine insemination, and I'm not an expert on insurance coverage because it varies so much from state to state, but it's my sense generally that now insurance will cover some of the lower level procedures like IUI, but often will not cover IVF. And I do think it would be a good thing if insurance covered IVF, in part because that also is one way we regulate medicine in this country. And in the state of Connecticut, there's mandatory insurance coverage for IVF, but the insurance companies also insist that the number of embryos transferred be minimized, and they limit the number of embryos that can be transferred, and then you're guaranteed another cycle if that one doesn't take. And that seems to me overall like a good thing, a good way to handle it. Often, if people can't afford IVF, they turn to IUI or using fertility drugs, and that is where we get the really high-order multiple births from fertility drugs. And so, you know, invariably when you read in the paper about somebody who's had septuplets, you know, it's typically a working-class couple who couldn't afford IVF who ends up with the really high-order multiples, and I think that's a problem.
Because the woman took the fertility drugs and then they conceived naturally or whatever.
Well, that's right, or through artificial, through intrauterine insemination. And when you take just plain fertility drugs, that can cause a woman to ovulate many eggs at once, and if they're conceiving, you know, naturally or using insemination, you know, that can result in AIDS conception.
I just remember about 20 years ago doing a story on this because there were groups that were fighting to get insurance coverage for in vitro fertilization, and it wasn't commonly covered, and I don't think it still is. Maybe state, you know, there are some policies that might do some of it, or some states might be different, but yeah, it's still, they were arguing insurance pays for all sorts of other maternity costs. It should pay for this too.
Right, and insurance will have to pay for the cost of that triplet or quadruplet birth, obviously. There are a handful of states where insurance coverage for IVF is mandated, but just a handful.
Yeah. Lisa in Fort Atkinson, hi, you're on the air.
Hi, I was curious if there's any data about how many frozen, unused embryos are out there. What is their shelf life, if you will, and what ultimately happens to them?
Oh, I'm so glad you asked. I have a chapter on that as well, and it's called Souls on Ice. You know, in this country, we have probably about 500,000 frozen embryos in storage, and it's just fascinating to me. I mean, as far as the shelf life goes, in San Francisco, there was a child born from an embryo that had been in storage for 13 years. Mm. So embryos freeze surprisingly well and can survive sometimes freezing and thawing and refreezing and thawing. And what happens, and this is just fascinating to me, when couples go through IVF and hopefully end up with children and then maybe had five or six or more embryos frozen, it's very difficult for them to know how to think about these embryos and to know what is the right thing to do with them. They can thaw them. They can donate them to scientific research, although that's not that easy. They could donate them to another couple, or they can leave them frozen indefinitely. And so far, the vast majority choose to leave them frozen indefinitely because they don't know what is the right thing to do. And a doctor did what to me was a fascinating study of how patients think about their embryos. And some of them think of them as clumps of tissue. Some think of them as living entities for which they have a parental responsibility. Some think of them as kind of an insurance plan in case something happens to their existing children. Mm-hmm. But they do tend to have a hard time thinking about them, you know, just dispassionately. And doctors are very afraid to dispose of frozen embryos if, as often happens, patients eventually stop paying their storage fees and move and fall out of contact. Doctors are afraid to let these embryos thaw because they're afraid that at some point there'll be a wrongful death suit or something and they'll be held liable. So there are companies now that exist to take over frozen embryo inventories and store them for doctors and to try and track down patients who've disappeared. And it's just striking to me, this company likes to take them over as soon as possible so they can stay in touch with the patients rather than let them disappear. So the person who's helping couples figure out what the right thing is to do is going to be some employee of ReproTrek who's calling you once a year or twice a year saying, you know, so you still want to keep them frozen? But there's nobody really, I think, helping people know what is the right thing to do. And I interviewed a woman who considered herself very liberal and very pro-choice, and she ended up treatment with frozen embryos. She had used both an egg donor and a sperm donor, people whose resumes were so stellar that she said, I felt it was a tragedy if these embryos weren't born. And she felt a parental responsibility for her embryos, and she found two women who were willing to bring them to term. So that's a pro-choice person who felt, nevertheless, very responsible for her three-day-old frozen embryos. I've also interviewed pro-life legislators who went through the process and when they finished up thought, well, I would be fine with these going to scientific research. They're just sort of fertilized eggs that are in a dish and they're not in somebody's uterus. And even though I'm pro-life, I really don't have any problem, say, with these IVF embryos going to stem cell research. So it's really fascinating to me how people's thinking about life was challenged and sometimes changed by this procedure.
I remember some questions some years ago about the safety of all of this, especially with frozen embryos, whether the freezing process would somehow harm the child that would result from the frozen embryo. Is there any more evidence on that?
Well, the safety of the procedures in general is something that has not been adequately studied, and people don't realize. I mean, one of the consequences in this country, there's a ban on federal funding for any kind of human embryo research, and we talk a lot about stem cell research and whether we should fund that. But IVF itself has been deeply affected by the fact that scientists cannot study these embryos if they get any federal funding, and most scientists do. So once an embryo is thawed, it has to be either refrozen or transferred. As one scientist said to me, you just have to jam it in the uterus and see what happens, because they can't, say, keep them in a lab for 12 days and see whether freezing has had an impact. So it's a big question mark, and part of the reason it is a question mark is because they can't study these embryos. But there does need to be a more concerted effort to track the health of IVF children in general. And I attended a pretty major government conference on this about a year and a half ago. The federal government is making an effort now to try and drive this forward, but it's something that up to now really hasn't happened in this country.
We only have about a minute to go. Are any public policymakers, working on things you think ought to be dealt with regarding these questions?
That's a good question. Mm-hmm. You know, a lot of this falls to state legislatures, mm-hmm. Who periodically will, often it's a conservative measure, say, to ban any of these procedures being available to single women. But I think if greater attention were being paid, say to informed consent for egg donation, that would be a good thing. But most of these efforts, I think, are going to have to take place on a state level.
Thank you so much for being with us.
Thank you.
Liza Mundy is a feature writer at the Washington Post magazine and is author of Everything Conceivable, How Assisted Reproduction is Changing Men, Women, and the World. Thanks to Carmen Jackson for producing The Hour and to Leo Duran for on-air production. I'm Joy Cardine. You're listening to the Ideas Network of Wisconsin Public Radio.